I'm going to call the council to order for the work session of August 1st, 2017. And we have, all of us are here. First item of business is COO communication.
I actually have two guest stars, and I'll put it into the good news, bad news category. So I think I'll start with the good news. Would you come on up?
I'm usually not associated with that part.
I know. But I took a little role reversal.
Good afternoon, Council. I'm Collier, Director of Finance Regulatory Services. As you recall, we are issuing issuing bonds to net us $60 million for our contribution to the OCC hotel project. So it's our $60 from bond sale, $10 from the state, and then we have 3.4.
Yeah,
okay. No, it's coming. I'm not giving the big reveal out right now. So when we originally started the project, and we're looking at this original debt service, $60 million, the total debt service, so that would be over the length of the debt, our length of the loan or debt for 30 years would range from $134 million to $161 million. And at that time, the rate was projected to be 4.6% to 5.3%. So that was kind of the range we looked. As late as January of 2017, we thought we would be about $4 million shy of the $60 million to actually do the funding. So we actually had to go to the FDA to ask for additional funds. We worked on the structure of those payments, so there's actual bond structure. So I worked with the City of Portland, and Multnomah County to look at that actual structure. We changed that to be more favorable overall. So today, we actually went to the market and sold bonds. That's not even good news. That's pretty darn important. Today, to meet the $60 million obligation, we sold $52 million in bonds. So essentially what that means is that we received the premium, actually if you include the closing cost, of over $9 million, or about $9 million.
Wow.
The interest cost over the 30-year time period now for the total cost of the bond is about 3.7%.
Whoa.
And the total cost of the bond over those 30 years will be $101 million.
Oh wow!
So that will happen. We will actually financially close next Tuesday. And so then again, I want to thank our team. We have a great team: OMA, finance, COO's office, council office. But I also want to be able to publicly say thank you to Kinross, the city, and Mark at the county to make all this happen.
So 2 years ago, we thought we'd be $4 million behind, and we wound up being $8 million ahead. So should we have actually waited longer?
No. I'm so done. We've admired this problem long enough.
Thank you for being frugal.
Yeah, well, whatever we would have saved, we would have spent in some sort of drugs, I'm sure. Calm ourselves down. Thank you, Tim. You
absolutely
did a great job.
Great.
That is great news.
All right, and now the person who normally has good news.
Thank you. It's usually a pleasure to be here, but following a consent report, I get to deliver some of the other information. But before we talk about the grants and the little part, do you want to talk a little bit about the Lunar?
Do you guys want to give an update on the Lunar Falls? Is that right? Or contacting?
I think
you want to do it later.
Sure.
Why don't we do that? We'll
let it
falls later.
Okay, no problem. Great. I want to just spend a few minutes and kind of brief you very quickly and answer any questions that you may have regarding the grounding of Blue Lake. I'm sure you both had the opportunities to read about it or see it on the news last night. I can tell you before we start that the staff did an excellent job in managing a difficult situation. So about 3 o'clock yesterday, we were notified by the contractor that operates the boat rental facility down in the Little Pad Boats. There was a person in the water struggling, and we services. We had the terrific response from Russian Fire and Rescue, from Fairview Police Department, the Lieutenant Sheriff's Police Department, pretty much everybody within the vicinity. Within a few minutes, we had our own boat in the water and began the search and rescue operations. One of the staff members of the contractor who was on site at the time was able to effect a active water rescue with one of the potential victims. Over the course of the time, though, it became very obvious that we weren't able to recover the second victim, and within 45 minutes, it became a recovery effort as opposed to a rescue effort. The individual who died was on one of our panel boats along with the other potential victim. They were given rented the boats. They were instructed in how to use the boats. They were instructed to wear life jackets continually. At some point in time, while they were out of the water, they chose to remove their life jackets and enter the water, at which point they experienced the distress that resulted in the drowning. We're still participating with the sheriff in ongoing investigations to try and determine the exact timeline for everything that occurred within those time frames. It took about 3 hours of searching. Eventually, the body was recovered. The family and friends were on site during most of it. Again, difficult situation. Once the body was recovered, we did notify the Hemi and the King up in advance, but things were concluded at that point in the operations. I think the important messages here is that it's going to be a long, hot week. Hopefully this will be our one incident. We know that there was a similar incident that occurred in Hague Lake 2 days ago. Yesterday there was a similar incident at Detroit Lake. And then our situation. So we are hoping that some of this is behind us. Unfortunately, lessons are sometimes part of the plan. With that, we have to answer any questions.
Questions? Anybody have any questions?
Were they minors? Or?
No, they were not. The victim was a 20 years old male. The woman, I'm not sure what her age was, is. Again, we have numerous sites out there that explain the procedures. They get a briefing. The boats are inspected. I think the newspapers, the television media, did a reasonably good job of reporting the information as we do it at the moment in time. More and more information, of course, we expect to come live over the next few days, but generally speaking, it was truly a horrible accident there. It does appear that all of our safety protocols, all the contractual obligations of the contractor were honored. They did do the right things at the right time. Unfortunately, the one thing that we can't always account for sometimes is human judgment.
Catherine?
So this is an incredibly sad experience for everyone, but especially for our staff. And with this incredibly hot weather right now, I imagine that it's all hands on deck. Absolutely. At the same time that everyone, all of our employees are human, and having to deal with all of you this incredibly difficult situation.
Yeah, so we do send the EAP out and we provide grief counseling to staff. That's probably the most important thing we can do right now. And then, of course, the prevention messages about helping folks not make a single mistake in the future. So, yeah, it's really, it's hard on them, and it's true that we don't have the luxury of being able to say, oh, we'll just close for a day or two.
Right. So thank you. Yeah.
From the report on the television, which is where I got my news last night, in fact, I think somebody on television even said that the staff did remarkably well in terms of rescuing the female passenger, and did essentially responded exactly correctly to the incident. So please convey our thanks to the staff for having done that, and we'll work with them any way we can to see what kinds of changes or what we need to do in order to make sure that if there's any loopholes in our system, that they get closed up. So.
We're doing a very active review of the incident. We had a debrief last night. I logged with them on this morning. I'm looking through the people with all the different information that becomes available. Do our best to respond appropriately.
Okay.
Thank you. Be safe.
Go ahead.
That's it. You only have two.
Well, these were both enough.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, thank you. Next item on the agenda is the regional waste plan.
Today we're here to discuss development of that plan. The last time that we were here with you, we shared the work plan for how we go about formulating a new plan. Today we're going to share the outcomes of the first phase of work. On your work session worksheets, there's a little series of boxes, and there's a red circle that says, "We are here." And that's where Mark and I are today to explain to you. This includes draft values and principles for the new plan that we'll be developing. We're seeking your approval of those values so that we can move forward with the next phase of work to develop a system vision. And this is what we're going to cover. So here's a little overview of today's presentation. Okay. And if you recall, this plan provides a blueprint for the direction of the solid waste and recycling system. It will establish policy direction, it will set some goals, it will outline roles and responsibilities. We do the plan so that we have a thoughtful, integrated, and systematic approach to reducing environmental impacts associated with the consumption of goods in our region. This plan should do exactly that by helping us address Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions that are associated with what we buy, what we use. It will reduce unnecessary mining or harvesting of the Earth's resources, protect kids and adults from toxic materials in our products, and make sure all of the region's residents receive and benefit from our important services. We do these plans about every 10 years. The current plan runs through the end of 2018. As we look towards 2030, we seek to create a solid waste system that is equitable, resilient, relevant, and even ambitious. I'd like to turn it over to Marta now to talk about the new plan and the outcomes from our phase one work.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for having us again. As Paul mentioned, developing the new plan is structured across five major phases of work that are shown up here with an equity lens spread throughout each phase. This is the first time that we've applied an equity lens to a solid waste planning effort, so we're excited to share the results of phase one. We kicked off phase one in March that aimed to develop the plan values. If you recall, the values are the essential concepts that serve as the basis for the plan strategies and actions and guide implementation. They establish the direction of the development of the rest of the plan. So when we are at phase four, developing the strategies, there should be a direct line of sight of the values down to those actions that we've adopted into our strategy. The values themselves, the draft concepts, were drawn from agency guidance, including state and regional federal plans regarding waste management and planning. have here. The draft values were further shaped through public surveys and community discussions. This next slide up here outlines the major engagements that have taken place over the last few months around the values development. And they included first engagement efforts targeting communities that have historically been not engaged or underrepresented in previous public outreach or opinion surveys. As a part of addressing this, Metro has worked with community organizations to hold discussion on the values that I'll talk more about. Second, the Equity Work Group reviewed the draft value concept from an equity perspective, and they provided input both into the value language itself, as well as developing the guiding principles that identify the racial equity elements beside all of the values together. Third, we presented the draft guidance to the Metro Policy Advisory Committee and the Solid Waste Alternatives Advisory Committee last month for consideration and got their review and input. And as a result, we are here today to present to you that draft guidance for your review and input. Before I get into the draft values, I want to just share some highlights from that engagement that I just went over. As I mentioned in the staff report, Metro is working with a number of different community organizations to serve people of color to hold discussions with local residents around the garbage recycling system. Here on this slide, you see discussions with those communities. The first picture shows a discussion with Central El Corral of Washington County, the state's oldest organization that offers services to Latino residents. The lower picture with Constructing Hope is an organization that offers a pre-apprenticeship program in the building trades for low-income residents and people with a legal history. The intent of these discussions were to not only help build an understanding and awareness of the system for those that are familiar with it, but also to get input on the draft values. Overall, the discussions reinforced perspectives that were also raised within our equity work group. In particular, the need to address historical impacts of the system, taking into account varying levels of access that exists within communities. We heard a lot about multifamily or apartment housing access concerns within these discussion groups, as well as people with lower mobility who do not have the same access as others, and the importance of valuing culturally specific knowledge. On this next slide, you see tours that were conducted at Metro Central Transit Station and the hazardous waste facilities with these different groups. On the top picture is a picture of Patient Wellness Council members from North by Northeast Community Center, a nonprofit medical clinic for low or no income residents focused on improving the health of African Americans. The lower picture is of Momentum Alliance members touring Metro Central, and this organization is a youth-led nonprofit whose mission is to inspire and mentor young people from around the region to set up the next generation of social justice leaders. Both the tours were conducted on weekends to accommodate the community members' availability. For the overwhelming majority of the folks that went out to those transfer stations and did those tours, it was their first visit to a garbage facility, and there was a lot of shock and awe response to the amount of traffic. And you know, all curious when you first go out there, it's overwhelming to see, and they sort of got a backstage pass in some of the instances the sorting lines were shut down, so they could really take in the different things that were going on and hear the tour as they were walking through. Questions and comments range from concerns about the safety of the garbage sorters and the diversity of the workforce to facility impacts on nearby neighborhoods, access for those without cars or limited income. People also talked about their personal relationship to trash and the environmental impact of their consumption and garbage habits. So it really made a difference to be present in that atmosphere and seeing those facilities around you, and really helped give us a different perspective as we looked around, shaping what these values and guiding principles look like. As I mentioned, the equity work group was responsible for looking at the values through an equity lens. They met four times, which was quite an accomplishment between May and June, in just 2 months, including one meeting on their own. The members are shown here at one of their values work sessions. The top picture shows equity work groups Rob Nathan, some of you might know through coalition, our partnership with Coalition of Communities of Color, Tommy J. Larocas, he's our youngest member of the equity work group. He recently graduated from high school. And Mary Lou Carrera. The bottom picture features Pavu. She is a nurse with OHSU and from Washington County residents. And this is her first interaction with Metro and experience with our agency. Emma Brennan and Andre Wheeler. Not Pictured is Juan Carlos Gonzalez, some of you may know from our partnership with Central Cultural. We have really, staff has been blown away by this group of people. We knew this was going to be a benefit and opportunity, but also a risk in not knowing what the experience was going to be. But each member of this work group has fully engaged with the material, posed really hard and smart questions to inform our discussions, and built an incredible camaraderie among each other, which is demonstrated by the fact that they went ahead and said, no, we're not done yet, we're going to meet on our own, and we'll provide you with additional input. It has really inspired and challenged our work, because without the participation in this process, we wouldn't be having those additional perspectives brought to the regional south, the regional waste plan. You may have felt the same way when you saw the principles that they developed that are in their packet, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So the next process, or next step, was both SWAC and MPAC review the guidance. They were both supportive and did provide some revisions to the language. Not significant modifications, but to emphasize different concepts that I'll mention as I walk through them. Here are the draft set of six values, and this is the top line of the values. Under each of these are some concepts that are further defined, which I'll show you on the next slide. We ended up keeping these more as bolted concepts rather than statements, because we felt we wanted to really focus and build understanding in agreement on the concepts themselves rather than getting into the wordsmithing of the statements. I want to just walk through the values briefly and call out some of the discussions that came, and feel free to follow along in your packets. The first value up here, protection of human and environmental health so current generations can enjoy clean air and water. This is really at the root of how we as government got involved in the solid waste system. And within the garbage and recycling system, it also means eliminating impacts of products from production to disposal. This includes both toxics and greenhouse gas emissions. One of the elements that was added to this as the values evolved was the concept of a store. This came through that equity work group discussion that puts an emphasis not only on protecting but also restoring past harms that have come to be as a result of the system. And so that concept was expanded within this value. The second value, conserve natural resources, provides for better use of resources and highest and best use. This really ties to our role and responsibility in the system of providing services, the opportunity to recycle, conserving resources. The third value, advanced environmental literacy, that includes lifelong learning for all age groups, civic responsibility and stewardship for the environment and community. Lifelong learning has been a long-standing value across all the regional waste plans. One of the expanded concepts that came out of our discussion, both in the community work group, community discussions as well as the equity work group, was from the equity perspective, the intent of community empowerment, that the intent of education is actually to empowerment in action. So that concept was added within this values. Next is economic well-being through prosperity and living well. With this value, in response to both the equity work group and community input, the value was included to include the concept of inclusive and access to acknowledge different degrees to which individuals may have access to opportunities. So it really changes the way that we look at fostering economic well-being and expands it. The next, the regional waste system is adaptable to changing conditions over time and recovery after disaster. MPAC, in our discussion there, really emphasized, and wanted us to include the concept of long-term viability of the system, that we not only want a system that is adaptable to changing conditions, but one that over the long term is steady and stable. So that concept was added in. Finally, the provision of high-quality services that are accessible to all. Both MPAC and SWAC had discussions around this and emphasized the importance of this value. One of the changes that was made to it was adding the word equitable. This came both out of, again, the community's discussions and was echoed by the equity work group, that there's a difference between providing equal access to all and providing equitable access that acknowledges that different communities may have different needs. multifamily is often the example that we use when we're talking about these types of services, so that came through really consistently in all the conversations. Next, the draft guiding principles. I mentioned the Equity Group had one meeting on their own to develop these principles and submitted the content for us. We included their original draft in your packet so you could see how we made changes to what it was in its original form. The revisions that staff made to it were intended to make it more specific to the solid waste system, so taking those principal concepts that they developed and applying it through the solid waste lens to look at how we develop our programs, and also making sure the language that is used is consistent with what's in Ventura's racial equity strategy, so there were some revisions made to that. The first principle of community restoration is an emphasis and acknowledgement for past harm and impacts in the work we do. The second principle emphasizes community partnership, access to decision making, community building throughout each value, and finally, resource distribution identifies resource allocation to communities of color, emphasizing that, and community reinvestment through plan implementation. There are additional details in the principles provided in your packet that discusses what these mean in practice. But really, the idea of having these principles be a part of the overarching guidance as we become a part of every element of the plan. We wanted to get your input on these values and guiding principles and are seeking your approval for appropriation of these elements into the plan itself to set us up for the next phase of work. So we have a couple of questions here for you today. I'm happy to click back to the other slides to go back to them.
Okay. First one is, do counselors have any questions or input on the draft values and guiding principles?
If I could get it up.
If you could get it up, then you might have actually a question. Yes.
No, my question was answered in the presentation.
Okay. Carlotta.
Well, mine is it's less of a question than thank you for doing this outreach, because I think it really is exemplary. And I don't remember the similar content in the old RSMOP plan, if there was similar content, but it seems pretty new. It seems to get to what we have talked about through our whole equity strategy, which is to be authentic, consistent, really responsive. I think you've really hit it right on these. I do wonder, so you said that the guiding principles that they came in with afterwards and you sort of rewrote.
Mm-hmm.
And you said just to be more specific.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that they came in and sort of restore pretty much everything bad that's ever been done to us. So, or maybe not. I mean, narrowed it into what we could do with the solid waste system.
Yeah, we didn't want to make the scope of the principles specific to the solid waste system. And one thing I did forget to mention is, one, after we made those revisions to the guiding principles that they provided to us, it was sent back out to them for review. So when we circle back after that, and they had no comments on the modifications that we had made. But it wasn't changed dramatically, we just wanted to make it applicable to the system itself. Because we presented at MPAC, and they were talking that you were at the meeting where the regional transportation was always being was also being talked about, and you can see when you look at these principles that they are transferable across our different areas of work. You can look at that those three that were up there and think about it in terms of transportation as well as the news planning. But we wanted to tailor them to the plan so when we're looking at implementing it, it makes sense and we're applying it appropriately to our decision making.
Terrific. Clarification.
For sure.
Marty, you're talking about the equity work group deliverable as the draft that the committee developed.
Mm-hmm.
That was powerful language.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Clarify what the group meant when it comes to community investment. Emphasize resource allocation to communities of color, historically marginalized communities. So can you give us some examples of what they were considering?
I think a good example of that is something that we already do is our community enhancement grant program, where we have those communities that have have facilities located in their jurisdiction, and they receive a grant fund to reinvest back in their community. So that's one example of community reinvestment.
And actually, Councilor Craig, you have talked about this with us in the past about the economic opportunities that the system presents and how are we making sure that those opportunities are available more widespread. We are working on our investment innovation program that Council President to start scoping out, but it also includes the $400 or so million each year that are circulated within this system, and where do those monies go? Who benefits from them? And historically, local, small, particularly minority-owned waste-related businesses have benefited from them. So we have some hard issues ahead of us to see how they might benefit from them. And it really is permeating really everything in our department in terms of how we are looking at our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in our provision of services to the region.
May I follow up?
Sure.
I was thinking of the community enhancement grants that you described. I was going to figure out how you do that. But I guess we'll cross that bridge later. But maybe that's a good point. I appreciate that.
Catherine?
Yeah, I have just two items. The first is a question. Several years ago, as part of one of our first doing things differently assessments, with the solid waste arena, the department stepped forward and participated in a cultural competency exercise and worked with outside experts with our solid waste work and recycling, and had developed a program that, with the principle of cultural competency, and executed it out in Washington County. And we got a lot of compliments about that work. It was very present in my district, and I'm curious as to how learnings from that program have been shared with the equity work group, and also how it gets integrated. And I know it's been a while, but still, it was great. And then the Vominos program followed that as well. So, and we worked with some of the same groups out there, but the staff has changed. So that, you know, historical reference point has left. But I still feel, as an agency, that we carry those experiences forward and advance significantly from them. So is there anything you recall from that or want to add?
Well, I'm looking at my folks that have been around a while, and the only one willing to make eye contact with me is Pam Peck. And I know Pam has worked on Hatch Porte and Vamos.
And Ashley's picking up that work right now on our Spanish language channel. So that's absolutely active and going. And Kendall and Ashley are working on our communications.
Thanks for the courage,
Pam. They did. Our staff did awesome work. Oh, it was great. The community loved it.
So that work is certainly not forgotten, and it's been very active through Pam. 3 weeks ago, we held our first culturally specific hazardous waste roundup at Centro Cultural. Everything was done entirely in Spanish, and we had our Spanish-speaking staff there to do that hazardous waste roundup. So these things are not forgotten. They're very much a part of what we're doing today. I guess I should say, would anyone else like to just comment on what Councilor Harrington is asking about? That sort of covered the gamut of our work.
Well, just to say that we have ongoing investments in that channel in Spanish language outreach. Communications is working to kind of revamp that effort right now. But that's been ongoing since we call that our Husky Parte, Do Your Part campaign, and we also collaborate with local governance in the region, and they also have their own independent efforts and partnerships in that area. And so there have been partnerships with the community
groups as well as collaborations with or hiring marketing firms who specialize. So there was an Indie Vision partnership last year as well. And so, you know, it might be a great time to have Ashley and Kendall come back and do an update on that sometime because I know they're developing a new campaign again.
I am very proud of the work that our staff has done in this domain, and I am very confident that you've learned to carry that forward. But I also know that while some of our staff has changed in with our partners, whether they're nonprofit or governmental partners, and they may not be familiar with some of our past work. Then the other point I wanted to share was a bit to a question, actually, on the values and guiding principles on page 2 under community partnerships. I received a question from a member of MPAC that I hadn't quite been in a position to, it's come up before, but I thought I would raise this. Develop authentic partnerships and community trust, And this person was inquiring as to what authentic means. And I turned it around from the standpoint of, well, what is genuine and authentic is something that we each experience. But it's, for me, more important that it's our community members that are feeling that we as a government and a agency that provides services to the communities, that they feel that the relationship is one that is true and long-lasting. But I was wondering, has there been any discussion, particularly with the Equity Work Group, around what that means to have authentic in there? Because it made me realize, I might be taking for granted what that means.
Well, Councilor Marion, I don't know if we have thoroughly discussed the word authentic, but really with Martha's leadership, we have talked more about these partnerships truly being two-way. Mm-hmm. In the past, a person might say that Metro got what it needed. We
yes.
had the input that we needed.
Yep.
And nothing really went back to the organizations that we mined for information or
yep.
help or for perspective. And we're trying to be much more thoughtful about that. And,
yeah.
and we might have maybe fewer partnerships, but deeper. They might involve paying stipends or other forms of payment to people that are willing to participate in our groups. It might involve creating our first ever culturally specific Has Waste event with the group. But it might also involve other connections that we can make with them. So our diversity, equity, inclusion leader in my department is Molly Chidsey.
Yeah.
And Molly makes sure that we have deeper relationships with the groups that we're interacting with.
So I'm very comfortable with, because we've discussed and used the same description.
Yeah.
So I responded with, well, there's ongoing nature of the engagement and making sure it's just not advantageous to us, but is meaningful for the other party. But it struck me that this was a member of MPAC that was raising this. So that's where I thought, we might need to spend a little bit more time because we're all in this together, right? Not just this program, but the nature of this work. So I just wanted to share that experience a little bit because we've talked about it a bunch. But I think we are all still, it's part of our journey in advancing equity, diversity, and inclusion in our whole region. So, thank you.
Councilor Dirksen.
Thank you. I have a couple questions on, and I'd like to drill down a little bit, if I could, into perhaps some of the conversation or discussion that took place that led to the drafting or the phrasing of the draft guiding principles. And under the first one, during conversation, did individuals share specific or general what they viewed as past harms or disproportionate impacts that felt needed that need to be stated in this way?
And with regards to the solid waste system, I think it mostly pertains to the location of facilities. And those that are living closer to facilities obviously have a more obvious and direct impact on what comes out of those facilities, whether that be noise or pollution or other things around that.
So it wasn't anything specific. It was just a general concept that being located near a facility places an impact on the neighborhood or the community.
That is what comes to my mind. There may have been something more specific that I would have to go back and ask and look for notes for a more specific example.
And then under community investment, where it's saying it emphasize resource allocation to communities of color and historically marginalized communities. And immediately, as did Councillor Craddock, immediately thought of community enhancement grants. Was there a thought or a recommendation that communities that maybe get those grants today that aren't defined as communities of color or historically marginalized would no longer get those or somehow should be divested from that program, anything like that?
No, I think part of setting up the principles is it sets us up for that discussion in the future for what that means as we get to developing what the vision for the plan is, that we look at these principles and then have a discussion around that, what that will mean on the ground.
Okay, that certain communities would maybe get a premium or something? I don't understand how that would work. I mean, there are neighborhoods or communities or jurisdictions where these facilities exist, and we distribute money to those. But how do you emphasize?
Well, I think an example that we use again quite frequently is multifamily and apartment housing. We're looking at that now in terms of prioritizing our work and resources. Generally, with our programming, we distribute resources equally across the residential sector. We now notice that there's a gap in service to apartment housing, and there's some service areas that need to be addressed. So, in applying this principle, that may mean then prioritizing our resources to that particular sector to ensure they're getting an equivalent level of service. Or the service that they need, not necessarily equivalent, but yeah. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Yeah, one piece. And also, the third element of community investment doesn't have to be tied to our community enhancement grants. It can be tied to other programs that council might direct us to conceive. Because you've really touched on this paradox, which is if the facilities are a burden from an environmental justice perspective, but also a benefit, which are they? And so we're trying to see that the system can benefit the people of this region in more ways than just through community enhancement grants. We don't have the answers to that yet, and these are just the values and the principles that will lead us toward those answers.
I have another potential example. We tend to provide sponsorships for different seminars, open events that are held generally on Saturdays. And I know a lot of members from the communities identified in this category that are working on Saturdays. And so maybe we need to ask, well, so how are you dealing with reaching an audience that may only be available on Sundays, for example? And finding out really what is the scope of the community who's historically been to some of these events only held on Saturdays for communities of color and historically marginalized community members, and how are they going to address that in this year's attendance so that they're increasing those numbers? It's just another potential idea.
Good point. Actually, and I really appreciate your reference to providing better service, particularly with regard to providing adequate recycling facilities at multifamily, where you have a much greater volume both of trash and recyclables within a small area in a multifamily, and it can be difficult to provide what they need. So needing to focus on improving that service. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Bob? Thanks, Mr. President. I first put up my tent because I heard my colleague, Councillor Harrington, referring to activities conducted in our district out there. And it struck me again that as somebody who lives in and is elected within the center of the region,
in there,
I never go out to Forest Grove. I never go out to Troutdale. I never go out to Happy Valley. I go over there. But you can characterize it any way you want.
That was a very strong word.
It's just not out.
Not back. No. So that isn't a serious comment on this policy.
So.
It's just goofy weather for me. Okay? What strikes me is that this is a stellar example of how we are, I think you process people call it, a learning organization. Mm-hmm. I was so proud to learn so much from the planning and development staff in the course of the division, then Powell Division Project, where where Metro and community partners work together, not just reaching out and expecting passive participation, but working with community leaders to bring representative members of communities of color to the table to think about things. And paying stipends is part of that. But that was an eye-opening process for me to learn how one of our departments could be a leader in engagement and shared decision-making, as we did in the steering committee, with community representatives. And then to see the venues with their leadership and deep experience in contracting with disadvantaged business entities on a wide variety of projects and programs, and seeing parks with the great work that they've done in with partnerships with communities of color in the grant process and elsewhere, and seeing all that work, you know, Marta picking up that set of lessons that we've learned and weaving a new program out of it. And it's just, bless my buttons, I think it's wonderful work, and I'm very proud to be associated with this staff. This team. Yeah.
So, I think that we heard the answer to the first question, which was yes, they did have questions. But I don't know that the questions necessarily infringed upon the ability for us to say,
yes,
yeah, we like that, we support the draft values and guiding principles. So I'm thinking if we do a thumbs up on that one way or the other. Okay, that gives you, so that gives
exactly
you the answer to the second question, yes.
Thank you very much. I just have one more wrap-up slide just to let you know what the next steps are. The phase two will kick off in August and will identify a vision for the future for the greater Portland area that Paul mentioned. And we'll be using a set of scenarios to engage the community policymakers to understand the different trade-offs and set a vision for the future and how we manage these materials. To develop these scenarios, and this is something different that we're doing that we haven't done in the past kind of processes, we will be holding a series of engagements that are shown up here on the chart. We will be collaborating with Metro staff, Equity Work Group members, and local government staff to develop these draft scenarios. And they're really just intended to illustrate different visions for the future and what the different trade-offs may be, so we can have a conversation of where we want to go. Following that, there'll be a public outreach and survey around the different scenarios. And then, in addition to a leadership forum series hosted by community organizations that will convene policymakers and community leaders in early October. We had originally planned, if you recall from the work plan, to do one large regional forum. But as a result of our work with community organizations and our desire to meaningfully engage those community leaders and elected leaders, we feel having these sub-regional forums will better achieve our goals. And so we will be providing you with more information and detail on these forums in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more. But wait, there's more.
We're talking trash today.
We are talking trash today. Yes.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Council President Hughes. I'm still Paul Slime here for the services. With me here today is Deanna Pitzler, CH2M, and Will Elder. And we're here to talk to you about what we'll do if Martha's plan does not succeed. In other words, what will we do with the nearly 500,000 tons of waste that has to be disposed of from Metro's public transfer stations? You might recall we met with you on July 18th. We gave you an update on the request for qualifications for landfilling and transport of waste. At that time, Dan reviewed the 2008 and the current proposed transportation criteria, and you all discussed how you would value those criteria. The feedback we received from you about the values in the transportation criteria was very helpful. While your opinions ranged, when staff evaluated it, we saw central tendencies, and we took them as guidance in how we would value the transport RFP. We look forward to a similar process today for our disposal criteria. You should also have a handout in front of you, similar to the one we used just 2 weeks ago. As we mentioned at that work session, we plan on releasing draft RFPs for public comment. This includes a wide range of public as well as industry stakeholders. We've also reached out to the four landfill host communities. In October, we'll return with feedback from what we hear, and we'll summarize how your criteria feedback from 2 weeks ago, as well as the feedback you will provide today, has been incorporated. So today is all about landfills. Most of Greater Portland's garbage goes to landfills. Despite the ambitions of our regional waste plan and other efforts, this procurement is for the approximate 500,000 tons per year of waste from our public transfer stations. That's almost 15,000 truckloads of waste. If you line them up end to nose, it would be 206 miles of trucks. As you know, Metro's contracts for transport and disposal of waste expire December 31st of 2019, so these solicitations will procure transport and disposal services for January 1st, 2020 and beyond. I'd like to pause there before I turn to Will to see if you have any questions about the context of this procurement before we proceed.
Questions? 170 trucks?
No.
1,500.
15,000. Per year.
15,000 trips.
Oh, trucks.
Trucks.
Yes. So yeah, 500,000 tons.
Yeah. Lined up, nose to
nose. I was just trying to give you a mental image of how many trucks that was, and if you were to line them up end to nose, how far it would stretch.
Well, 30 tons a piece.
It's just it's a lot of trucks.
It's a lot of trucks.
Yeah.
More than half.
I apologize if that was those numbers too. Will?
Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, President Hughes, councilors. 2 weeks ago, we came and gave you an update on the disposal request for qualifications, our procurement communications, and Dan walked you through an exercise to capture feedback on our transportation evaluation criteria. Today, I'd like to cover the evolution of landfills over time and then briefly highlight some features of our four qualified landfills. Dan will then walk you through a similar exercise as 2 weeks ago, but just for our disposal criteria. Four landfills we've qualified represent the learnings and evolution of landfill design and waste practices over the last 100 years. Some of the past practices are long forgotten, but others may still reside in our memories. As we think of our evaluation criteria today, I believe convenience was given 95 points in the past. The the edge of town, a wetland with no development value, a ravine, or just dumping a body of water were most popular options. As we moved into the 1900s, scavenging, using the pigs, and then burning were also common practices, or you could just burn your waste in the convenience of your backyard. Post-World War II saw a major shift in thinking of sanitary landfills. All the previous methods lacked decent sanitation standards, and solid waste was regarded as a health issue. In 1953, the U.S. Public Health Services stepped in to help provide guidelines on preferred disposal. Some of those guidelines were no open burning, no swine feeding, and no scavenging. In 1961, the guidelines were updated to also include geological considerations of the site for water pollution, 6 inches of daily cover were recommended, and closed landfills should be managed. As daily cover began to be used, flaring the gas became a way to prevent odor and keep landfills safe. In 1976, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, was passed by Congress to address landfill standards, but it wasn't until 1984 that Congress gave EPA the authority for landfill standards. In 1991, the EPA delivered requirements that closed or altered existing landfills and required that all new landfills have water and gas monitoring and also be lined to protect groundwater. The modern landfill had arrived. By putting out a request for bid for landfills in 1989, Metro helped usher in the development of modern landfills, which are really more like waste mountains. Our team has not been content on just protecting the safety of the public and the environment, but has asked that our landfills do more. This is why it's important for any of the landfills proposing to not just flare gas, but to put it to use in either production of fuel or energy. Based on our current best practices and standards, our community will be getting the best. I'd like to briefly describe some features of the 4 qualified landfills and give you some quick demographics on their host communities. This will better familiarize you with them before we talk about the evaluation criteria. Some of what I'll talk about is information I shared 2 weeks ago, but I also reached out to the landfills and asked them to provide me any talking points they wanted to share with me today. So here you see a map of the 4 qualified landfills and the counties they are located in. Columbia Ridge, Finley Buttes, Roosevelt, and Wasco County landfills successfully demonstrated that they have more than 30 years capacity when one or both of Metro's 2 public transfer stations' waste is added. They have also demonstrated that they have or will have landfill gas to energy or fuel in place when our contracts begin January 1st, 2020. Both were key criteria in our request for qualifications. All 4 landfills are located east of the Cascades, which provides a dry climate and ideal for landfills. While the population of the 4 counties varies from 1,800 to 26,000, other characteristics are similar. The median family income ranges between 43,000 and 50,000 per year, and people of color represent between 5 and 9% of the population. The following are features the landfill owners wanted to share with you about their operations. All are top-notch operations, and they have a lot to be proud of. Columbia Ridge is where we've been sending our waste since 1991. Gilman County and Waste Management conceived the idea of the landfill as a way to help Metro with the closure of the St. John's landfill. It is serviced by rail and truck. Currently, it produces 12.8 megawatts, enough electricity to power 12,500 homes from its landfill gas. Columbia Ridge has a 10,000-acre buffer that's managed for agriculture and wildlife. It has unique geology to support superior environmental performance and has 148 years of capacity. Columbia Ridge is a state-of-the-art landfill engineered with environmental protection systems that meet or exceed rigorous state and federal regulations. The site is also a platform for green innovation for the future. Columbia Ridge has a history with collaborative technology projects. Today, it is home to more than 90 wind turbines and suited to provide critical infrastructure and expertise for future technologies to reduce what goes in the landfill. Columbia Ridge generates $3 million annually for the county and is championed by Gilman County as a rural-urban partnership between the local community and Metro. Finley Buttes is owned by Waste Connections and located in Morrill County, Oregon. It can be serviced by rail, truck, and barge. It currently produces enough electricity from its gas to power 3,000 or greater homes, as well as uses the heat generated to help dehydrate onions and Cascade specialties. They are active in Laurel County and support many organizations such as 4-H, Family and Agriculture Museum Foundation, local schools, and Oregon State University Agricultural Research Foundation. Finley Butte has 500 acres of permitted airspace and has 112 years of capacity. Roosevelt, which is owned by Republic and located in Clickitat County, Washington, can be served by rail, truck, and with modification, also barge. Geography, climate, and science combine to create a landfill that far exceeds all state and federal regulations. They use their landfill gas to generate 20 megawatts of electricity from 30,000 or 430,000 homes, with an enhanced heat capture method to generate an additional 17 megawatts for another 25,000 homes. This is the largest and most advanced gas energy facility in the Northwest, with capacity to evolve and grow. There is a renewable natural gas project underway to introduce pipeline quality gas generated from the landfill into the Williams Northwest Pipeline, and it will qualify for renewable identification number credits. With an operating capacity of 5 million tons a year, the landfill has 100 years of capacity. They employ nearly 200 representative machinists receiving living wages and many residing in rural Oregon. Wasco County is also owned by Waste in Action and located in Wasco County, Oregon. Trucking will be the primary mode of transportation for this landfill. They're making improvements to the entrance of the landfill and installing two new scales. In their response, they indicated that they would have gas to fuel in place before January 2020. Wasco was the only landfill to identify only one transfer station, Metro South, for its equivalent tons. Wasco has a strong connection with the local community and recently participated in a bike bill to give 50 bikes to local charities. They have an excellent safety record, with the last 3 years being incident-free. The landfill would have another 42, or will have another 42 years of life, even with 25% growth year over year for the last 4 years. Before we move on to the disposal criteria, are there any questions about landfills in general or any of the four qualifying landfills?
Thank you, Mr. President. Will, if you could repeat what you said about Wasco solely seeking for Metro South waste only?
Yeah, they respondents had an opportunity to indicate whether they were one or both, and they were the only one that said they would prefer Metro South. And I suspect that's because of the capacity. Taking both of them would probably push them over that 30 year.
Because they would no longer have a 30 year.
Yes. Yeah, they only have 42 years.
Catherine? Well, I've only been to two of these four, so I'm looking, and on Columbia Ridge, you mentioned 10,000 acres of buffer, and it may just be that I wasn't listening intently enough. I was going to assume that in all four of these cases that adjacent properties are in agriculture use, and so there's, and I don't know how to address if they're similar buffers, though the scale may be different.
So these talking points were all provided by the landfills. In our tours, my recollection is that all have a buffer zone, although I don't recall what they are.
Okay.
The other thing is this capacity is what they're currently licensed. So many of these landfills actually have the capacity to expand in the future, but we wanted only what the license is permitted for.
Thank you.
I had a quick question about the waste. So, does Wasco County also have waste to energy, or is it strictly waste to fuel?
Currently, Wasco actually has no landfill gas to energy, and that's primarily due to the mix of waste that they receive. You heard a lot of megawatt numbers, and that's really a function of the mix of waste that they receive, how much waste, and some of the technologies. So what they're saying is that with Metro's waste, that mix will justify introducing the landfill gas to fuel.
Okay. But they would convert it to usable natural gas, is that the idea, or... A fuel.
Compressed natural gas. Their proposal indicated that they would either use it for their fleet, or depending on who came forward for transport, they needed that is fueled, but that would be a possibility.
So are all of the ones that do waste to energy, the availability of methane to make the to produce the heat for the energy conversion is dependent upon the mix. As we move, if we successfully move food scraps increasingly out of the mix, does that affect their ability to stay viable on waste to energy process?
I would suspect that the response to that would vary depending on each landfill because of the mix that they're getting from other communities.
Sure.
However, in talking with people, even when we remove the food waste from our waste system, we will still be producing methane with the waste that we deliver.
But I'm wondering if it's in quantities enough that would be worth the bother, other than just... At some point in time, I assume that you reach a point, as we kind of have with Smith and Bidey, where you're not producing enough of it to be economically viable anymore, and you might as well just flare it. So we're not in none of these cases within our projected lifetimes or those of our children or grandchildren likely to see a time when that will happen to them.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect qualifier. I mean, some point, someday in the future, when the landfill is closed, there will be a diminishing amount produced. But
by which time the earth will have shriveled.
Because of the lifetime of all of these, I don't think it will happen even in our grandkids. The other thing is there are other things driving us. I mean, you know, when you think about the value, so we didn't even really talk about this with transport, but each one of these contracts represents about $10 million a year. So if you're thinking about a 10-year contract, that's a big incentive for me to kind of see a way in helping Metro achieve its goals. So the ROI might be a little different for these projects based on the overall goals of the landfill and what they're trying to do. So, you know, one of the things that I think came up was in the Roosevelt proposal when they talked about tying in with the Williams. By doing that, that allows them to receive those credits, which means the gas that they're selling becomes way more or higher priced commodity than what they would typically get. So, you know, they're thinking about this, but there's a lot of variables.
Craig.
Thank you. I know exactly where three of these are, but I don't know exactly where Wasco County is. Can you give me an idea?
Matt.
And it's south of the Dalles. I know that. I knew that.
You can do township ranging section, or you can do a state address.
Yeah, it's right off of Highway 90.
W197?
Yeah, 197. So to get there, you actually drive a little east of downtown the Dalles, mm-hmm. and then take the highway up.
So like which banking curve is it along?
No.
Yeah. Is it north of... So, yeah, exactly. That's it. South of the Dalles is the town of Duper. Is it north of Duper or south of Duper?
It is north of Duper.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good job. That appears
fair. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dan Pitzler. Dan is an economist with 25 years of experience in solid waste management and system planning. He has extensive skills in benefit cost analysis, feasibility analysis, and transfer and resource economics. He'll walk you through our public benefits and our proposed criteria for our disposal RFP. Next, he'll explain point suggestions developed by staff as a starting point, and then open up for any questions or suggestions you have for a team related to the criteria and its weighting.
Council President Hughes and Councilors, back to you, Matt. So here we have another slide, similar to what you saw 2 weeks ago when I was here. In the left column, we have the public benefits of the regional solid waste system. The second column shows the proposed disposal RFP evaluation criteria. And you could just about look at the words, and they're almost exactly the same from what you saw before. So if it looks familiar, it is. Of course, the public benefits haven't changed, but they're mapping a very similar set of meeting criteria that we have for the transportation RFP. So protecting people's health, environment, and material usage aligned with environmental impacts, being good values for public money aligned with cost, being adaptive response to how materials are managed aligns with the operational aspects of their proposals, their experience, and the risk of Metro, and ensuring services available to all types of customers aligned with both community and university. So these are the proposed criteria that would be used to help distinguish one proposal from another. Then back behind this is a more detailed set of attributes that in more detail describe what those criteria mean with respect to disposal. And here's where we have some differences. We have both the different operations for a landfill and a transportation company. So environmental, we would look at things such as the extent to which there have been historically in compliance with permits, how sustainable are their operations? Are they going above and beyond what they have to do? Some of the landfill gas management, we've heard a lot of great things about it. Are there any things that stand out and make one better than what's required or better than another? For operations, the issues are a bit different than transportation, but how they historically deal with their interface between when the transportation company, when the truck arrives, how is that working with landfill operations? How easy are they to work with? Do we have is a very well set up and smooth interface? Because the problems there will come back and affect your station. So how is that likely to work? Hours of operation and days of operation, how flexible is it likely to be to accommodate the issues that are faced at metro stations, contingency plans, emergency plans, all those types of things. We want to evaluate how each proposal is going to do. Community diversity would be quite similar to what we saw with the transportation RFP, focusing on workforce diversity, wage and benefits, COVID, subcontractor equivalent, and community relations. And then for cost, it would again be a formula-based cost calculation. One twist here, though, of course, the landfills are not located the same distance away from Metro, so you have to consider the distance away and how much that transportation is going to cost to really evaluate the landfill's proposal. So the cost here would include the cost of the highest rated transportation proposer to that landfill in addition to the landfill's cost. And once again, it's a formula-based calculation related on the percent above the low-cost proposal with adjustment points. So those are the primary attributes that staff is proposing to use to evaluate the proposal that we've received.
Okay,
so
question.
Here we are again. So you have to have in front of you a form that looks very similar to what's on the screen. And we're asking that you take some time to consider your values and how they map to those criteria. There may be some questions though before we start. I'd be happy to entertain any questions before we get going.
Catherine.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. And maybe I'm reading too much into the reference chart. But on cost, you know, the other column that you have with cost is get good value for the public's money. And the part that I feel is lagging a little bit there, and just focusing on cost, is the job side of things. You know, with receiving, one of these landfills receives metro area waste already, though it may be a lower percentage than it has been, I don't know. So I don't know if that means a potential loss of jobs, but these other three landfills aren't receiving the benefit of metro waste, and given the potential volume, I don't know if it means a potential add of jobs. It could be zero, it could be more than zero. And so, you know, there's the, in your subsequent chart, you just have community and diversity talks about the workforce makeup, wages and benefits. So I get that, but I don't know if that's just here's what our standard wages and benefits is, or if that also comprehends the nature of, you know, job expansion or loss. So I that was my first question. Could you just speak to how that's comprehended?
So, you know, with having the comments here, we talk about fixed costs and variable costs.
Mm-hmm.
We would certainly be asking for that feedback in the response. I think all four landfills know that the jobs are very valuable to us, quality jobs, the diversity. And, you know, when we talk about diversity, of course, we want employment of people of color, but we're also talking about veterans, women in the workforce, you know, so mm-hmm. we're looking for them to kind of really think about what that looks like. We haven't really thought about that as a cost component, but really in the a component for our diversity section.
Yeah.
And so, but I think, you know, if the feedback is that it should be a consideration, that's good for us to hear.
So, I'm a little uneasy that it's under this category of community and diversity. It's this element of scale having community value that I just can't quite get anchored on. And so I'll just live with my uneasiness for now. I'm wearing that sweater and see how it feels. My other question is, with each of these landfills, do each of them have community enhancement fees? I mean, is that part of community relations in the next chart?
Yeah, they do have host fees, and they vary depending on county. But our anticipation is that we'll see that as a component of the disposal fee. So, you know, in Columbia Ridge's slide, they talked about the $3 million that goes to Dillon County.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are fees not only for Metro, but other municipalities that are using. This is an economic benefit for any county that receives from a finance point of view, just strictly for the budget.
Okay, so what I'm trying to gain is to understand the criteria model such that some respondents may have, you know, if I think about the consumer reports, there's some economic benefit and others may have more economic benefit. Which of these four, environmental operations, community and diversity and cost, will that come up in?
Community relations.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Those are my two questions.
Craig. Thank you. When looking at the different considerations under community and diversity and looking at community relations, one of the things that I thought of when I was looking at this was relative impact of the landfill on the local community, negative impact on the local community. When this council made decisions that precluded future use of the Yadkin County landfill, that was one of the major considerations, is because what impact it has on the community around it. So was that part of the consideration under community and diversity, and specifically under community relations, on what kind of impact? And that's one reason why I asked about the precise location of the Wasco County, because it's much closer to existing communities than the others.
And that's actually probably the perfect example of the closest. The other three are very, very remote. We are drafting the draft RFPs, which hopefully will be released soon. And one of the things that we're asking for the qualified landfills to do is provide a letter of support from their host community. And then we're hoping to have an opportunity to hear from the public. We're hoping that our newsletter goes that far. So far, two of the four counties that I've reached out to have expressed interest in meeting with the team and discussing this. So we're encouraged. Hopefully, if there's concerns about that we're hearing that, and we can actually take that into consideration for the final RFPs and revision. Because the whole point is to hear this up front, so that we're not hearing it after it's, you know, too late.
Yeah, for me, that needs to be a consideration. What kind of negative impact could it have on a surrounding neighborhood?
Okay.
So. Give folks some time to
put a number on these?
Let's go to the drawings a little bit.
It should add up to 100.
You're always putting limits on this.
Did you get my calculator?
In. It's just input. I looked at the previous chart, the one that had the four columns, and reflected on those a bit, and I bet, you know, I'm making assumptions. I can't imagine that hours and days of operation is going to be that much different. Safety, you know, all these companies really work hard at this sort of stuff. Emergency procedures, financial strengths, you know, none of them are laggards. So out of operations, you know, the transport interface is a really important one. On the environmental side, yep, those are all pretty important. On the community and diversity side, I've already spoken about that. You know, the scale of the jobs, in addition to what you've already enumerated. And so, actually, what I thought about is, you know, I don't want. So, really, what I came up with is, yeah, cost is important, but I wanted to. I didn't want that to overshadow some. Differentiation of these other factors. So I thought, well, what if cost is 40 and environmental impacts are 20, the operational approach 15, and the community and diversity 25? Yeah. It's just an idea.
40 on cost.
Yeah.
Okay, Craig, got it.
Yeah, I think Catherine's point on operational approach and experience, we're assuming that we're going to have a relationship with a company with which we can work, and that they're and ethical and also. But it is still a consideration. We want to make sure that we don't chain ourselves to someone that isn't reliable and needed. So, but of the considerations here, that is the least. So, because you would kind of assume that. So, 15% for me as well. But I thought that environmental impact. I mean, that's why we do this. Otherwise, we'd still be like 100 years ago, dumping in a ravine or in a well. That's why we do what we do. So. Environmental impacts need to be a primary concern. So I said 40% there. Cost, we need to make sure that we do things efficiently and are good stewards of tax dollars and or fee dollars in this case. So I said 25%. And then for community and diversity, also, you know, what I like about all of these landfills is that they are located in areas that are economically challenged. And have high unemployment rates, and so we are providing jobs in those kinds of areas. And I think that's an important consideration. So I gave that 25%. And that came out to 100, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Alana?
Well, I'm going around and around. I'm mindful of what Sam said at the last discussion, which is we make assumptions that whoever, when we get to the last four, that they're all going to do all of that really well, which doesn't help you at all in terms of figuring out how to weight them. And I think my weights are a little bit arbitrary, frankly. I do assume that they're going to be a strong operating entity, and so I only weighted that for 20%. And I assume, again, because of the community, I ranked that, because where they are located, I ranked that at 20. I am very concerned about the impacts. I gave that 30, the environmental impacts, and the cost 30, because it has to be good value. But honestly, it's a little arbitrary, because, I mean, they're going to be, I would presume, they're going to be pretty close. That's fine. And I'm not necessarily sticking to it.
Yeah, I'm kind of right on the bubble between humility and humiliation. Because, so, to try to simplify from last time, I said, okay, 25% each, now modify from there. So I kept environmental impacts and cost at 25%, and then started borrowing from operational approach to get community and diversity to 30. And my thinking there is, there's a range among these communities, all of which have tough economies. Wasco County's population and economy is about 20 times the size of Carroll County. It's just ballpark, right? And so I think part of that community relations thing is giving these proposers an opportunity to make the case about their relationship to the community that they're in and the economic importance to that community. We've got two opportunities to help as many as two of these communities and counties. I think that ought to be weighing on us as we make those choices. I'm with Carlotta and others who say, these guys are going to come in, they're going to have their pencils sharpened, they're going to give the best possible price they can, they're going to show the kind of technology and service they can provide. They're going to do a great job on these applications. These are great companies. So I'm looking also at communities that can be served by this economic investment. Okay.
So I kind of followed the trend on the operation approach. You know, it's not like we're hiring, or it's not like Fred Sanford is in the competition here. So, I rated that at 15. I think there may be some differential, but I don't think it's going to spread these companies apart very much. Environmental impact, again, I kind of almost came as along with Craig. I went with 25% cost. It seems to me that that cost is going to be a key factor, so 15. And then I agree kind of with what everybody else has said, is the community and diversity is a really big. So I went with the other 25 points there.
I really got
the 90
if you would say no.
Come on, 40, you're right. You saved your
when it counts. 40.
That's the dark one. Just throw it and see what.
I say 15, 25, 35, 25.
Oh, so you had cost at 35?
Yeah.
Okay. So you offset 15 and cost at 35.
Okay. Everybody? Okay.
Next. Just the key questions.
Okay.
I don't know. I think we gave you four different opinions.
Oh, this one, you guys.
So here's what's next.
50%. You guys are conservative on that. That's good.
Well, I think it's assuming that everybody's going to be pretty close on all the criteria, would be my sense, and it's just we can do it most cost effectively.
The host of reason I think behind this part of this, we had a request for qualifications, so these landfills are all presumed to be qualified. And we know about the landfills, they're all, you know, like some of you articulated, they're all, it's not Sanford and Son, large companies, but it's not all landfills, they're not real landfills. And the cost, I'm not really sure how much variability we're going to see, but there could be a reasonable amount. So we thought there was a reasonable push on there. So, just different approaches. I think we heard some strong, consistent opinions to value community diversity a little bit higher than your standard 20 points that has been said in all part of Asian Habitat. We kind of agree with the opposite. I'm sorry,
could you speak up?
Yes. The operational side of things, I think we kind of agree. We're all pretty close on that. So I think perhaps we'll take this into consideration and make a few adjustments. There's dramatic differences.
Yeah, I don't see the dramatic differences. I could live with your numbers. Or anybody else.
I want them changed.
Yeah, 50% of cost of it is going to be too much.
That's too high.
If they're that far apart, you can tell.
Maybe. But again,
put it differently, for me, 40 points on cost is a ceiling, not a floor. Did you get enough from us, or did we end up giving you
too much?
Five different opinions. So you think you can sort through a proposal from this?
It's actually easier than 2 weeks ago.
More
consistent and quite helpful.
Okay. So did we answer question one for you? And question two?
Yes.
We like the evaluation criteria, but obviously we had our own point.
Do we have any evaluation? Do we have any other comments?
I do have one short one, and it kind of comes under operational approach, but I guess if all else being equal, the level of sophistication and forward thinking that these different landfills have toward energy capture and how they would deal with that would mean something to me if you need a tiebreaker based on the other things. The fact that they're looking forward and really trying to capture the methane and do something valuable with it, whether they're generating on site or being able to put it into the grid system, so to speak. To me, that's impressive and something we will need to consider more and more in the future.
Catherine?
Yep, I have another question. We have so many things going on right now that I can't quite keep one process straight from another process. And I really like processes and systems. So could you run it by me one more time? No. I know we're here. We've just commented on the criteria. I need a reminder. Where are we here? Where are we going next?
Next step.
Great. So, these two work sessions were really important for the team to hear your feedback. The next step is going to be to release the two draft RFPs for public and industry feedback. We are looking to get those posted on the website, hopefully by August 11th. And then leave that open for 4 weeks for feedback. I have two scheduled appointments with four of the counties, and I'm hoping to hear from the other two soon. And then what we'll do is once we have that feedback towards the end of September, I'd like to sit down with the team and summarize kind of everything that we've heard, from what we've heard from you, from the community, and come back and really walk you through that feedback. Any surprises that we maybe saw, and then how that's influencing our thoughts on the final RFPs, and see if we can get kind of an endorsement in that direction. Once we do that, we would like to, that will be October, I think, for a work session for October 3rd, when we'll be coming back. Assuming that there's a couple weeks of changing and editing those drafts to get them finalized, we'd like to put them out and have those set out for the community or the industry to sharpen the pencils as brought up, and then come back in January with a due date, and then we would evaluate that in February and March.
If I might, what is a reasonable time to have RFPs like this out for comment? I have a recollection. Is it like a 30-day process, 120-day process?
Especially for transport. I think with
No, once you have a final RFP, What is a general response period?
How long are we going to leave it out?
Yeah.
On the street?
I think it's a lot of the project team understanding the complications of what they're asking. And so, you know, a landfill pretty much knows a lot of its costs. They can talk about their community. They're going to have an easier time than, say, the transport, which is going to have to be talking to the landfills about how that interchange happens at the tipper. They're going to need to figure out staging, you know, how long it's going to take them to purchase equipment. So it becomes a little bit more complicated, and so we felt 3 months was really necessary.
Cool. Thank you.
Well, I want to kind of second what Craig said. When I look at the criteria, to me, operations is kind of the day-to-day. That's the sort of fundamental base. You want to make sure they're checking all the boxes and doing the job right. To me, the environmental piece is kind of what Craig was getting to, is sustainable practices, landfill gas management, and I would look favorably on a company that is kind of going beyond the minimum, going just beyond compliance to really being innovative, really looking at being proactive about protecting the environment and getting the most out of the garbage that I view as kind of a resource. So to that degree, I did put 30 down for environmental impacts because I thought of that as sort of the innovation side. And I think that's something that, and they're all really close, and a couple are just stellar in energy recovery or their practices that are being innovative. I would look more favorably on that.
Thank you. And it might even include things that aren't directly waste-related, like what kinds of equipment do they use at the facility and how do they power that equipment.
Exactly.
And so that's where we're trying to seek out the more innovative companies here.
Yeah. Right. Okay. You get enough?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Us too. Thank you. Counselor Communication. Councilor Collette.
I have one, but I was going to test staff in case you have staff who need to, in case you have questions for staff, but I think we're okay here. I wanted to let you know the status of the Lama Falls project. We have obviously a completed design and a completed design contract for that first phase. We are moving into the refining the design, permitting, engineering, construction phase. And we will be issuing another RFP for that. So HEDA has gotten us to this phase. They may, probably, will apply for the RFP to do the rest of the work as well. But we decided that since the project is so complex, that there will be a second RFP. Originally, we thought we could be able to go all the way through, but it's just really a complicated process. So, and you may get calls from people. If you do, please refer them to me, or if you want to, if you have questions, I can probably answer most of them.
So I will say that the follow-on is that you did approve CMEC, Alternative Procurement Process here in Lambert Falls, and because we're going to let the SNOHEDA contract expire and go out for a new design, we're going to see another modification of the alternative procurement method. We still think we want the general contractor and the designer to be working hand-in-hand. It just will probably be, well, there's a possibility of making a difference.
Because we'll give deference to the contractors.
Because we're going to go out for bid, a proposal for the designer.
So it depends on who they team up with.
Right, exactly.
Councilor Harrington.
So this may be a silly question. Really, thanks to our team,
right.
I'm familiar with CMGC. So there is a different method?
Yeah, there's multiple alternative procurements for construction. And they'll explain all the details.
Thank you for not making me go through a test to name them because I would fail.
No. Not today, not about a briefing.
We'll have a briefing. We're not going to ask you to get that decision along.
The office has such snappy acronyms.
I don't know if they all have their own initials. I think everyone's called the wrong bill. Anyway, so.
Well, as usual, thank you for looking out for different methods that will yield the best public benefit. This is a once in a lifetime project.
Yes, we've got to do it exactly right. So.
No pressure. No.
Anyone else? By the way,
it's summertime.
Hey.
Yeah. I can tell you about the stuff I did with my grandson.
An executive session. Somehow I thought we had an executive session.
Next week, right? Next week.
Next week.
Let me give you just a quick rundown of the Zoom we'll be making. I think maybe you saw Zoom will be making day-to-day decisions about how late they stay open. Tomorrow and Thursday, they are already planned to close by 4 o'clock. You know, when it's over 90 degrees, no one goes to the Zoom. And when it gets over 100 degrees, it may not be safe to have the public at the Zoom. It can get even hotter.
That's all that asks.
All the pavement. And so, they'll be closing early in case you get any complaints. We'll let you know about Friday and Saturday.
And before you all leave the room, I have a personal question to ask.
Okay, you wanted me to adjourn the meeting?
Yes.